What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora na, I a koe, and a good blum morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you live from Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea. It has been a special edition of Pacific Beat here in PNG, celebrating the country's 50th independence anniversary. And of course, alongside me is co-host Belinda Koro. With that, I say, you all right?
Yeah, right. Good morning. Good morning to you and good morning to our listeners.
Yeah. Well, look, you're going to hear more stories from PNG on what has helped shape this country. More on that shortly, but we say thank you, Tru, for joining us here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, PNG's independence is not only a Papua New Guinean story, it's an Australian one too. Thousands of Australians worked in the country before 1975, and some stayed on after. The most visible were the patrol officers, or KIAPs, as they were known. For many, they were the face of the Australian administration, particularly in rural and remote areas. Liam Fox spoke to three former KIAPs who were in PNG at the time of independence. Elderly men now, they still cherish the memories of their time in Papua New Guinea.
Looking at the three elderly gentlemen sitting around a picnic table in a Brisbane park, there's no indication of their colourful pasts. Get them talking though, and stories of incredible adventures flow freely.
PNG was an unknown country. It was exciting. They were contacting people there for the first time. They appeared to be quite volatile and warfare. The reports were all about unrest in Papua New Guinea. I thought that was very interesting. I was keen for excitement and adventure. That's why I went.
I was at an agricultural boarding school, and an old boy came back and he showed pictures to us boarders of building an airstrip up in Hagen, and I thought, well, that was great.
As a kid, I had an uncle who'd been on Bougainville in the Second World War, and I'd always had this, I think that's where the initial sort of fascination came from. I grew up in the Mallee in Victoria. There wasn't a whole lot going on there. I guess I was looking for a bit of adventure.
Bob Hoad, Peter Salmon and John Dagg were among the hundreds of young Australian men who worked as patrol officers in pre-independence PNG. Bob's first posting was to the Southern Highlands, one of the most remote areas at the time.
I was there for 5 years in all. First thing we did was to contact the people, talk to them, explain what we were trying to do to bring peace to the people, because they were in constant warfare with their neighbours.
Patrol officers were the arms of the Australian administration in what were then the territories of Papua and New Guinea between 1949 and 1975. Some went into areas no outsiders had been before, as this ABC News story from 1964 explains.
Because of the difficult terrain, patrols in this area are short ones. Mark Lynch will be away for about 2 weeks, climbing at times to well over 8,000 feet. It is called a routine patrol. However, in Kuka Kuka country, almost anything could happen.
KIAPs performed several roles: policeman, magistrate, administrator, census taker, surveyor, and more. Peter says it was exciting work.
It's always interesting. I think other KIAPs have said the same thing. You posed the question of, well, was it dangerous? Well, it wasn't really. You'd go out to sort out a tribal fight, and if you ever got sort of roughed up, it was by accident. I mean, the locals or the people who were warring, they had nothing against the KIAP, you know.
Though there were times of unease at the actions of the administration and Australian companies, like when John was in Bougainville when the Panguna mine was being developed.
Here we were amidst helicopters, drill rigs being dropped in. What appeared to be endless supplies of brass and steel and the whole thing unfolding behind us. Then trying to deal with the antipathy of the local people who saw it as total destruction.
The Kiaps were seen as instrumental in nation building after World War II. As independence drew near, they also became teachers, educating people about self-government and democratic elections. Independence itself in 1975 came with mixed emotions for the men.
It was the end of my career.
I thought this is the way things are going. I knew I wasn't a Papua New Guinea citizen, or I knew I was a temporary feature in the overall scheme of things.
It was then that the real understanding that things were drawing to a sort of natural conclusion following independence.
Such was PNG's impact that all three came back to work in different roles at various times. And after all this time, they still cherish those years and are proud of their contribution to what is now an independent Papua New Guinea. Here's Peter.
Papua New Guinea, that was the best experience we ever had in our lives. I mean, no regrets whatsoever. It was just a fantastic life.
And that is former Kiap Peter Salmon ending that report from Liam Fox.
Pacific Beat.
The leaders of Papua New Guinea and Australia have signed a communique agreeing to the text of a new defence agreement. It paves the way for the Puk Puk Treaty, which will be signed once the cabinet of both countries approve it. Despite being delayed, the PNG's cabinet unable to meet this week, Prime Minister James Marape is adamant his government will sign off on the treaty.
The process of cabinet is confined to the cabinet itself. There's a reason why you call it cabinet. What happens in cabinet stays in cabinet. What comes out is, in a democracy, majority agrees. And as I say today, the cabinet will have a handle on this matter. As soon as cabinet finishes it, it will then be processed to the next stage. And we anticipate to have a quick turnaround. It will not be delayed. It's an important, monumental occasion to commemorate our 50th anniversary.
Once in force, the treaty will elevate defence relations between Papua New Guinea and Australia to an alliance and integrate the two military forces. But what will this mean for Papua New Guinea? Joining us this morning to talk more about this proposed Puk Puk Treaty is Jerry Singarok, former commander of the PNG Defence Force. Good morning, Mr. Singarok.
Yeah, good morning.
Firstly, do you share Prime Minister James Marape's confidence that this treaty will be approved by PNG's cabinet without delay?
Well, I think the Prime Minister Marape got it wrong. The cabinet does not have the authority to enter into a security treaty because it violates a potential violation against the PNG constitution. And therefore, the first process is for the cabinet to determine whether we enter into a long-term security treaty. And then it has to be tabled in parliament. It has to be debated in parliament because it will require a constitutional change. The constitution is everything to us because it implicates Papua New Guinean soldiers or Papua New Guinean citizens working with the Australian army for the interest of Australia. This is about Australia. This is not about Papua New Guinea, because Papua New Guinea is a sovereign country in 1975. What Australia sees as its threat and enemy is not the same as Papua New Guinea. We're a sovereign country. We can enter into an agreement for joint training, joint exercises, but when it comes to facing a common threat, and it's common knowledge that Australia sees China as the potential threat. And I must say from the outset is China is not Papua New Guinea's enemy. And that's why there's a lot of speculations about the Puk Puk Treaty. It's a disaster if we enter into this treaty without understanding the long-term implication on Papua New Guinea's constitution and sovereignty.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singorok, for that. We understand that the Prime Minister Marape had said that the government had asked for it, the PNG government had actually asked for this. What are you hearing on ground on this, especially?
Well, right across those very experienced strategists and lawyers, constitutional lawyers, have already made contact with not only myself but other former commanders about our views, and their views are quite similar to ours, is that whilst we acknowledge that Australia is our closest friend, the issue of sovereignty is paramount. Papua New Guinea is an independent country. There has been no public debate. This matter has never been tabled on the floor of Parliament for a parliamentary debate because, like I said, there's serious implications not only on the Constitution but on the sovereignty of our nation.
That's my take. Do you agree that it's a procedural delay and one that will be signed off once Cabinet meets?
Like I said, the Cabinet can sign it off. The Cabinet can sign it off as the prelude to a debate in Parliament because, like I said, to absorb the PNGDF or Papua New Guineans into the Australian order of battle is a serious business because it means bringing Papua New Guinea into Australia's interest. Like I said, a Papua New Guinean is a Papua New Guinean. He's not an Australian. We have issues of status of force agreement. We have issues of joint cooperation, but it doesn't mean that we go and fight together against a common enemy. And let me remind listeners that Papua New Guinea declared itself to be friends to all and enemy to none. In 1975, that policy has never changed. That policy has never changed. And I am hoping that the Prime Minister Marape and his Defence Minister and senior cabinet ministers will look at the long-term implications of what they're getting our country into. This is geopolitics. This is this is superpower rivalry, and they're taking smaller Pacific nations into the fight. And we have to be very sensitive. Let me assure listeners that China is not our enemy. China is one of the largest trading partners with Papua New Guinea.
I'm talking to Jerry Singorok, a former commander of the PNG Defence Force. We're chatting about PNG's military future and a proposed treaty with Australia. Mr. Singorok, one of the goals of the proposed treaty is to integrate the two military forces. The PNG Defence Force is a smaller partner in this operation. What impact would this have on PNG's military?
Well, the operational word is integrate. How can you integrate the Australian Defence Force or PNG Defence Force into the Australian Defence Force? It requires a very, very intense scrutiny of the Constitution, and obviously Section 202 of the Constitution gives roles and functions of the PNG. That particular section has to be amended to take into account the absorption of the PNGF into the Australian Army. And like I said, there's too much at stake on the basis that suddenly Australia is now appears to be interfering with the sovereignty and the constitution of our country just to meet its strategic interests and for the defense and for the interest of Australia. That's all I can say. This is nothing to do with Papua New Guinea's safety and security. This is about Australia's interest. And what I'm saying is that why can't the ADF without signing this treaty based on the Defense Cooperation Program, which we have already, come and rebuild the defense force. Why are no Australian aircrafts being used by the PNGDF pilots? I mean, how do we justify this? There's a lot of things that are not making sense as far as I'm concerned, because the whole process has not been thought through, and that's why I'm saying that we should stop. Marape should stop and realize the long term implication on the sovereignty of Papua New Guinea. And I'm saying that if Australia wants Papua New Guineans to join the Australian Defence Force, then it should make it clear. Then Papua New Guineans will have to now apply for citizenship, go to Australia, and work as Australian citizens and join the Australian Army. It's simple as that. You cannot be a dual citizen and join either army. It's not heard of. That's why I'm saying that there's a serious implication on Section 202 of the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Singarok. Do you think there will be public opposition when tabled in Parliament?
I have no idea. I mean, the matter is just being discussed now because of the events of the independence. It's now finished, and I'm sure a lot of Papua New Guineans will wake up to realize that suddenly Australia is knocking on a doorstep to absorb the PNGDF or Papua New Guineans into the Australian Army. And I'm saying that, well, it's a welcome move. We got 2 or 3 million young Papua New Guineans who are looking for jobs. I mean, this is a great opportunity for them to move to Australia and become Australian citizens and join the Australian Army. But not at the expense of the sovereignty and the constitution of Papua New Guinea, and that's my point.
Mr. Singarok, Australia faced delays in signing security arrangements in Vanuatu last week and PNG this week. Is this a sign of reluctance by Pacific countries for exclusive security arrangements?
Well, all you can do, like I said, most of the Pacific nations are fully aware of the superpower rivalry in the Pacific, and this is basically Australia and USA trying to lure Pacific Islands countries not to enter into some form of agreement with China. It's all about their interest, and I'm sure the Melanesian Spearhead Group, I'm sure the Pacific Island leaders are fully sensitive about the behavior of Australia and US in light of a possible threat from China. And they're just trying to lure smaller Pacific nations into the geopolitics in relation to power struggle in the Pacific. It's simple as that.
Thank you, Mr. Singarok, for your time this morning. That's Jerry Singarok. He's a former commander of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
As we've heard this week, Papua New Guinea is one of the most diverse countries in the world, with more than 800 tribes, each with its own language and traditions. Over time, though, it's also become home to a small but lively Tongan community, many students building connections between Tonga and PNG. And during the 50th independence celebrations, Tonga's very own Crown Prince Te Pōtoa Ulukalala joined the Tongan community for one night of song and dance. Amongst those was Sekona Taulepa, who has been living in PNG for over 30 years, and I got to speak to him about his journey and what this anniversary meant to him. As a Tongan who is living here in PNG, how did you even arrive here?
Firstly, I met my late wife. The plan was to come and watch the SP game, because PNC hosts the 1991 game, And she asked me if I could come home. She sponsored my ticket and everything. And then after the SP came, my late wife had our first girl, daughter. And I was just confused and what to do, so I decided to I'll stay back. I'm still here since then. There are a few times going back and forth, visit the family at home, but my roots are grown in here.
So how many years now has it been you've been here in PNG?
I put it in, let's say it's 34 years. It's long enough, I guess.
What is it about PNG that you wanted to just stay and still live here instead of going back to Tonga?
Good question, yes. The fact is I established a lot of good friends. And going back home, I know it's home is home. But while I have the opportunity to be abroad, my children grown up here, so I decided to stay here. But unfortunately, my wife passed away in 2021. So I remarried and I love this country. I learned a lot. It's different languages and different people. I mix around with them a lot. I feel secure to go around on the street.
Well, so since you've been here for like 30 years, have you been able to learn the language or like Tok Pisin?
Tok Pisin, yes. I'm fluent with Tok Pisin. But Modwen, I'm still trying. But Tok Pisin, yes, I'm fluent in that language. And everywhere I go, I know a lot of people, they Tok Pisin, yeah. They understand me, I understand them.
Is there similar cultural values that Tonga and PNG have?
Oh, yeah, in some way. There are a few similarity in custom and things. Food-wise, yeah, we have the same thing that we buy from the market. That's one thing that I love here because I don't miss any food in Tonga. Like, we got them all in here. So many different languages. They have their different cultures. It's a beautiful country.
Can I just ask Sekona about the Tongan community? How big is it here in PNG?
Not many, actually. There's most of the community here, the families coming for work opportunity. They work, private sector, they come on a contract, bring their family. But those who live here, they married in here. Women, they marry with Papua New Guinea and they live here. But otherwise, bulk of the community here is Pacific Adventist University. But families like myself here, it's not many. But otherwise, the community, they come and go, I'm still around here.
I know that we are about to meet, you know, the Crown Prince, yes, of Tonga. Yeah. What does that mean, having to have him here and have this moment together?
It's special because it's a kind of a chance of a lifetime, you know. I mean, if we are home, there's no way we can go near the Crown Prince. No way. But in here, we meet some high-profile ministers who come over here, and then it's a great moment. Chat with him and shake his hand. It means so much.
It's the 50th anniversary of independence for PNG. What does that mean for you, though, as a non-PNG person living here?
50 years is a good milestone for the country. To be here in this country at this time of the year, we feel special that we are part of that. We witness that. Because we might not celebrate another 50 years again. Maybe my children, yes, or my grandchildren. But that is a very significant day. We witness the colorful things happening. But otherwise, I'm glad to be part of the 50th anniversary.
And that there was Sekona Taulepa, Tongan community leader here in PNG.
Much is written about World War II, but in some areas of the Pacific, memories of the conflict is fading. In Papua New Guinea, tales of the war once passed down generations at village campfires are being lost with the passing of elders. And experts fear the loss of historical knowledge is playing out in dangerous ways, as Kyle Evan reports.
World War II came in the form of a crashing plane for Ian Jijiro's grandfather. The American bomber slammed into a swamp not far from his village in Oro Province, where it remained for 60 years.
When we were growing up, they used to tell stories about that plane. And we usually go see that plane.
Eventually it was salvaged and shipped to the US. But its removal stripped away a major visual reminder of the war. All of a sudden, tales from the conflict, once passed through generations at village campfires, began to erode.
When a relic was there, we usually get scared because ammunitions, things were left there. Today's generation, they don't care. They just, go around. They don't bother about, war like that.
That loss of historical knowledge is playing out in other dangerous ways. Among the knowledge being lost is the location of unexploded ordnance left over from the conflict.
There's a huge need for education on our history.
That's Oro Province Governor Gary Juffa. He fears deaths and injuries from munitions, landmines and UXOs will increase as memories of the war continue to fade.
Because we're an oral history culture, we don't write our history down. We pass it through plays and stories and legends and poems and whatnot. The people who carry these stories are dying. So that part of our culture is also dying, the transfer of such information.
That's not the only issue.
People from specific areas in Oro was this World War II ordnance, that was making it difficult for them to access their land. And also it was an issue raised by law enforcement officials in my province as well, who stated that, criminal organizations or individuals had found a way to use the World War II ordnance, and I, for one, was almost shot with a 30 caliber bullet from World War II.
Now an international NGO has agreed to help. Mr. Juffa has signed an MOU with the Halo Trust, a firm dedicated to removing unexploded ordnance from war-torn areas. PNG program manager Stephen Tarlu says they will train Papua New Guineans to sweep areas riddled with hidden explosives and remove devices from the ground.
They'll be trained to conduct survey and to attend with to EOD call-outs. The process will be just to identify and map the hazardous areas, looking for evidence on the ground. And then we'll move on to technical survey. And lastly, conducting battle area clearance, which is excavating the ground to remove the threat.
The secondary component will be educational.
So we'll be going around into schools, communities, educating people, especially children, about the dangers of UXO, because children are they're the ones always on the ground playing, and they are the ones always picking up stuff from the ground, and it's usually a grenade or a 60mm mortar.
It won't be Halo's first venture into the Pacific's battlegrounds. In Solomon Islands, Calvin Sese is one of Halo's team leaders on the island of Guadalcanal, the site of one of the bloodiest battles of the Pacific theatre.
I wasn't learning history. I was experiencing it. So the elders who saw the fighting, they told me that this bomb, don't touch it. And that's how I got to know what an explosive ordnance looks like.
Much like in PNG, memories of the war have also faded with disastrous consequences. In 2022, a fire lit for a Mother's Day barbecue in Honiara detonated a US artillery shell, killing two and injuring 30 others. A similar incident claimed a father and son a year earlier while they prepared dinner on a piece of roofing iron.
When the new generation, they've grown up now, they're not familiar with bombs lying around, but they don't know that there are items under the ground. And that's the danger.
Halo Trust signed the MOU with PNG almost 80 years to the day since World War II ended. Experts have welcomed it, but say it will barely make a dent in removing the thousands of tons of explosives that still lay scattered across the islands. John Rodsted, a researcher at humanitarian organisation SafeGround, says no systematic survey of unexploded ordnance has ever been carried out, and PNG is one of the most affected.
People often say, look, we fish, we do stuff with the ocean, we don't go farming. We might have a little market garden around the house. But the fear of actually turning the earth and going and getting some proper crops in, which is going to give them some good health and some good economic return, a lot of places they just don't do it.
And that's John Rodsted, a researcher at the humanitarian organisation SafeGround, that report from ABC's Kyle Evans.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk. Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beach. Good morning and thank you, Drew, for joining our team here. Look, here with me is co-host Belinda Cora. Bells, last night was, very much a highlight for many of the Papua New Guineans here. Can you sort of share with our listeners this morning what was happening last night?
Yes, last night actually started in the afternoon yesterday. We had like people within Port Moresby line up at the Sir John Guy Stadium at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for a show. For a show that they looked forward to, which started at probably 9 p.m. In the evening. So, yes, I should say the experience, the crowd, I mean, us attending was something else, because it actually gave us that experience as well. Like for me personally, I've never ever attended a concert that was well attended, tickets sold out, a crowd of almost 19,300 in a stadium for a capacity of 15,000. That experience in front of a huge stage that many were thrilled to see, and also overwhelmed by the lights and the smokes. I mean, we had little kids too, the oldies there. And unfortunately, those outside the grandstand could not be able to get a good glimpse. But the ones who got the tickets that were actually, $30, yes, were actually the ones with the front row seats. So it was an experience. It was an experience to also have. It was also a good experience for plenty. I mean, most of our artists, don't get a chance to be, introing an international artist like Akon. Yes. And for that opportunity for Marianne Masani and Daddy G, who have, especially Daddy G, who was never given that opportunity, I think he was just like, impressed with what had happened. Exhausted after we spoke to him backstage, but he was just overwhelmed, overjoyed, and, he really enjoyed that experience in also, interacting with his fans out there. And, of course, the new, our new R&B, hip-hop boys, up-and-coming young stars in the arena here, in the industry, they also, put on a good show last night. And of course, yes, Akon wrapped it up.
Yes, he did.
That experience of watching him live on stage was something else. I can't even describe that. And, if I can't describe it, you can just imagine everyone who probably didn't know one of the songs or two of the songs, but watching him there on stage was something. You could see it on their faces when the lights lit up and the smokes in their face. They didn't even care, as long as they could see Akon on stage and they were able to see him. We might not even get the chance to see him again. So I think that experience for me and for many who attended last night was something that they will talk about for the next couple of days.
Yeah. It was definitely a highlight this week, watching across from our hotel the thousands lining up on the streets to enter the event. But yeah, as we walked in, I felt the vibes from everyone the moment we walked in to that sort of front stage. Hearing the local artists, that was probably my highlight too. As much as Akon was the main event, but hearing the local artists have that platform, they were so good. And so yeah, I loved seeing that. It was the biggest crowd, wasn't it? That's the biggest crowd that stadium has ever had.
I've not ever had of a biggest crowd. It's almost 20,000 for a stadium that's been, that I know that has a capacity of only 15,000. So, yes.
We squeezed in a little bit more.
Yes, definitely. There was one grandstand at the back of the stage. It was empty.
Yes.
So I'm thinking it's the one in the middle where the grass, the lawn is. That's where most
the
of the
people,
the crowd was. So, yes, just something else off the limit.
It was a good time. So if you were there, if you're tuning in here from PNG, I'm sure you were there with us along, clapping, singing, just dancing. And that was it. I love how PNG people, the vibe, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It was just the MC itself too. The MC came on and they were screaming for her too.
Yes. So. She's one of a kind. She's actually a really, really good MC in the city in most of the gigs because of the way she psychs up the audience. So Everyone loved her.
Yeah.
She was able to give them what they wanted.
Yeah, definitely. She was able to hype the crowd, keep the crowd entertained, while every single next act was, you know, preparing to come onto stage.
Yes.
But yeah, shout out to that new, I think, drill rap group. They're called Disease. But look, besides, they're not. They definitely were infectious on that night with the music that they were playing. So I really did enjoy them. And just, yeah, I thought, well done to PNG for putting on something like that during these celebrations. So,
definitely.
I mean, and there's still a lot more. This is only our second to last broadcast also, Belinda, but I believe that, you know, we are still waiting for our lamb flaps.
Yeah, I should point out that, you know, thumbs up to the organizers too.
Yes.
Security was really good. Everyone went home safe. You know, there was no incidents or major incidents outside. So, yeah. A really good night.
I really felt safe that night. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us here on Pacific Beat. This is Yours in the Pacific.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
A documentary on Papua New Guinea's 50 years of independence and the country's shared history with Australia was launched this week. Track to 50, as it is called, was released by community group Kokoda Track Foundation. It celebrates and captures the stories of those whose lives the organization has touched over the decades. Finau Fonua spoke to Ian Kermish, the chair of the Kokoda Track Foundation, and Courtneyella Dotson, who assisted in the production of Track to 50.
It captures stories from persons whose lives were touched or impacted by the Kokoda Track Foundation and their work. It included these people, including myself, visiting multiple KTF project sites all over the Oro province and also tracking part of the Kokoda track up to the Isurava battlefield. Once there, we shared reflections from young Papua New Guineans like myself and Australians with close ties to Papua New Guinea also.
Could you describe some of these projects?
Yes, a couple of the projects. KTF's work centers around four main sectors. So that's education, health, equality and leadership. Under health, they have a Kicks for Kokoda program that targets kids aged 12 to 19. It's a 9-week program where they're combining soccer, rugby, basketball, all these types of sports with life skills, teaching kids about reproductive health, respectful relationship, and encouraging healthy behavior within the community. This project is done in partnership with the PNG Olympic Committee and Grassroots Soccer. So after the 9-week program, the PNG Olympic Committee comes to these areas that have Kick for Kokoda programs, and they host a big competition. So it's an opportunity for not just the kids to learn about life skills, but it's an opportunity for the Olympic Committee for the country to scout potential sportsmen for the national team.
The relationship between Australia and Papua New Guinea, that's one of the major themes of this documentary, right? Could you describe that relationship?
So if you asked me this question 2 months ago, after not having walked the track, I probably would have given you a different answer. But I think now after walking part of the track, I've gained a new appreciation for the relationship between the two countries. In saying that, I must make mention of a time when our reliance on each other in Kokoda was one not just for survival, but born out of mutual respect and friendship. That bond, that reliance turned into a partnership that now stood the test of time. Today, Australia is PNG's closest and oldest friend. Australia is also PNG's largest development partner, supporting crucial work across all sectors in PNG. And describing that bond, I think it's a bond based on mutual respect for each other's cultures and people, but it's a partnership also built on the foundation that is our shared history.
It features some of the work we do in the immediate region around Kokoda Isurava and, you know, a number of the recipients of our support, including in the health sector. highlighted and profiled in the documentary. What you see in that documentary is largely about traditional core area of the Kokoda region. I guess the thing to understand is that KTF's work is undertaken right across the country of Papua New Guinea these days. So what you're seeing there is a sample, and the work is done from, you know, Western province, to Bougainville and New Ireland and Momase and so on. It's an organisation that works right across PNG.
Australia, is it a priority, a regional priority for Australia to have a strong relationship with Papua New Guinea?
Absolutely, it is. Papua New Guinea is our closest neighbour. How could it not be? If you want to see signs of that, you've just got to look at the extent to which Australia is represented today in Papua New Guinea for its independence, not only by the Prime Minister, although that's important, but by a range of other senior representatives of the country, judicial figures, senior ministers. The extent to which we're reaching out and engaging across every field, from security to sport in the NRL field. You look at the size of the Australian High Commission in Papua New Guinea, which is one of the largest missions that Australia has in the world. And if you want to use the size of an aid program to indicate a commitment and priority, then clearly Papua New Guinea is by far the largest bilateral aid program that Australia has with any country. So all of those are signs of the high level of priority and commitment that Australia has to PNG.
And that was Courtney Dodson, an officer at the Transparency International Papua New Guinea, speaking there to ABC's Finau Funua. Now to Timor-Leste, and over the last few days, students have taken to the streets in protest over a proposal by Parliament to spend millions on buying new cars for the country's politicians. Here's what the streets of Dili sound like. What started as a gathering of around 1,000 university students has grown to double that, with many critical of the move amid ongoing economic hardship in the country. Police have responded using tear gas as tensions escalated, and there have been reports of clashes and injuries. Our reporter, Vonya Vieira, has been covering this, and she joins me this morning. Good morning, Vonya.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. The situation. Tell us about these 65 cars the government has planned to buy, and why did this issue spark these protests?
Yeah, so every 5 years, Parliament plans to purchase new cars for its members. Climbing vehicles are needed to carry out supervision in the region and to monitor government programs. But demonstrators are questioning why members must buy luxury vehicles such as Prado or Pajero every 5 years. They argue the expense makes no sense when many people still living in poverty, like health and education services, remain in poor condition. So this year, Parliament has proposed purchasing another 65 Prado cars. And students strongly oppose the plan, saying the Member of Parliament already have Prado vehicles booked 5 years ago and that are still in good condition. Yeah.
Yeah. And so besides the car issue, is there any other issues that the protesters have raised?
Yeah, another issue raised by demonstrators is the lifetime pension granted to Members of Parliament, the President of the Republic and government officials. Protesters also voiced the concern about a looming fiscal cliff, warning that Timor-Leste remain heavily dependent on petroleum fund, which is expected to run out by 2032. They say this would have a severe impact on the domestic economy and are calling for the state budget to be managed more responsibly and invested in productive sectors such as agriculture, tourism, education, health, and clean water. So protesters are also demanding the repeal of the lifetime pension law, as well as the law that bans demonstration within 100 meters of parliament the president policy and other government institutions.
Vonia, how have the government or how did the police initially respond to this?
Yeah, so on the first day and the second day of demonstration in Timor-Leste, serious clashes broke out between police and demonstrators. Police used tear gas and even entered the university campus, assaulting several students and ordering them not to stage protests on campus grounds. Students resisted that, saying the police had no right to violate campus autonomy or commit acts of violence that breach human rights. And the second day, Parliament announced they canceled with purchasing new cars for members. So it's a good news for demonstrators. But so far, the Prime Minister and the President of the Republic have not commented on the protesters' demand or the police violence. And apart from dialogue held between members of Parliament and student representatives on the third day, so the meeting among members of Parliament and representatives of students lasted around 7 hours. And in the end, Parliament agreed to repeal the lifetime pension law to allow freedom of association and demonstration without distances, registration, and to increase investment in productive sector, which is currently receive less than 3% only of the state budget. And Parliament also passed a resolution canceling a processing of 65 new cars for its members.
So I have to know, what does the wider public think of these protests?
From my observation during the 3 days, both directly on talk debates on social media, the majority of people support the student protest. They feel the students are giving voice to their concern by rejecting the purchase of new cars and demanding the abolition of the lifetime pension law, which is, they say, doesn't benefit the wider public, especially given the difficult conditions still faced by communities and in rural areas. And at the same time, many people also calling for the demonstration to remain peaceful without violence or causing panic in the community.
Vonia, we know that last month similar protests had happened in Indonesia after parliamentarians were there giving a housing allowance. The country's youth again took to the streets to protest this, burning down government buildings and looting politicians' houses. How do you think that protest influenced the one happening now in Delhi?
So during the 3 days protest organized by the student of university from several universities in Delhi, on the second day, there was a clash between the demonstrator and the police, resulting a chaos due to the shooting of tear gas, throwing stones from demonstrators, and even burning a government car park near the campus. And the atmosphere was a bit tense for a few hours, especially on the first and the second days. And on the third day, there was throwing of stones at the parliament building, and the police had shot tear gas, but after being able to control it again by police. While waiting for the results of the meeting between parliament and the spokesperson from the university, but not looting the house of politician.
Look, even now, after days of protests, Vonia, how has the government responded?
So until now, the government has not commented, but only the members of parliament have discussed the demands of the protesters. Yeah.
Yes. And so what do you think is going to happen next? What are the next moves?
So the results of the negotiation on Wednesday, the members of parliament have agreed to the demands, and each party faction signed the deed prepared by parliament and also signed by the university representative, and that the results of the negotiation are valid. And on September 25, next week, parliamentarians will discuss these demands in plenary to pass a new resolution. And the demonstrators are waiting for the resolution that they will cancel everything that demonstrators are asking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before we wrap up, Vonnie, I just want to know, from what you've seen, are kids still on the streets at the moment?
Only during the demonstrators, during the demonstration that happening 3 days, but after the announcement by the parliament and the representative of university, everything is calm and peaceful, and nothing happened in Delhi.
Well, thank you very much again for your time, Vonnie. I really appreciate you keeping us across this situation.
Thank you.
And that there was Vonnie Vieira speaking to me from Timor-Leste.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Aggie, how are you going?
Yeah, Malo Lele, it's good to catch up with you guys. Shouldn't say guys, I should say men, eh?
Yeah, we're big boys.
You know what I mean?
We're adults.
I haven't been described as a man for some time now. All right, I am a guy.
Okay. I'm always good to know.
We're chilling.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground having conversations and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, leaders of Papua New Guinea and Australia have signed a communique agreeing to the text of a new defence agreement. However, experts warn the long-term implications of the treaty might come at a high cost for PNG.
It's common knowledge that Australia sees China as the potential threat. And I must say from the outset, China is not Papua New Guinea's enemy. It's a disaster if we enter into this treaty without understanding the long-term implication on Papua New Guinea's constitution.
And that's Jerry Singarok, former commander of the PNG Defence Force, speaking there. Well, remember, it'll be our last time here in PNG broadcasting live in Port Moresby, but we'll be back at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time alongside my co-host Belinda Cora. Stay tuned because your news is next on ABC Radio Australia, and then coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o doa whaatu, this is Pacific Beat. Yours in the Pacific.